You're listening to episode 95 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right?
Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? As you might have heard in recent episodes, I am totally geeking out about having Overdrive as a sponsor. I've been a fan of theirs for 6 years, and I am so honored to share their exciting news about their brand new app called Libby. It's designed for readers to discover and enjoy ebooks and audiobooks for free from your library. I have way more amazing details to share with you, so please be sure to hang around at the end of the show. I'd also love to wish our Facebook group members a very happy birthday. Happy birthday to Kristen Britt. I hope you had an amazing time celebrating last week. And happy birthday to Amy Lewis, Kara O'Malley, and Tiffany Jung. I hope you ladies have the best time this week. We have none other than Melissa De La Cruz in today's new episode. Melissa is a New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, and Publishers Weekly internationally best-selling author of many critically acclaimed novels. Her Blue Blood series has sold over 3 million copies, and the Witches of East End series became an hour-long television drama on the Lifetime Network. In today's episode, Melissa shares the inspiration behind her book, Alex and Eliza, and what the writing process was like. We also discuss her novel called Something in Between, which follows an overachieving Filipino high schooler who came to the U.S. when she was 9 years old. Though it's not autobiographical in any way, we touch on how Melissa's own move from the Philippines to the U.S. and her experiences with a very complicated green card situation laid down the emotional foundation for her character's voice. Further into our conversation, we talk about why it's important for writers to have a solid support system and good critique partners. For listeners working on a manuscript or entering the query trenches, you'll definitely want to keep an ear out for her advice about dealing with rejections and recognizing when you've finished your novel. Now let's dive right in.
We have Melissa De La Cruz with us today. I know a lot of you are very excited and love Melissa's work. Both you and your children and your family all love her work. Melissa, how are you? We're so excited to have you on the show.
I'm great. Glad to be here.
How is your Father's Day?
We worked.
What?
My husband's, his first debut fantasy novel came out. So we were in San Diego at Mysterious Galaxy Bookstore. And he was promoting his book and I was interviewing him. It was a working day.
That's really exciting. Congrats to your hubby and congrats to you, because I'm sure that you were there for a lot of back and forth during his writing process and supporting him. That's a big accomplishment for the whole family. First of all, holy moly, you've written more than 30 books. That is insanity. How does that even work? Like, what is your schedule like? I feel like you don't even have time to sleep.
No. I must look more productive than I am because I have a pretty easy life. Everybody's always really worried about me. And I wrote a lot of teen books. I had a book that came out, a couple of series books that come out every 6 months. So that's why the count is so high. I have the Au Pairs, the Ashleys, Blue Bloods. These are all series books. So there's always at least one or two that publish a year. Ever since I think 2006, I've published about 5 books a year. I'm doing what I love. I quit my job as a computer programmer when I sold my first novel. And that first year, I sold 5 proposals. So I was always wondering, I was like, oh, I wonder if I didn't have a day job for 9 years, maybe I'd have even more books now. I don't watch TV. A lot of my free time is working. I'm either outlining or I'm writing a first draft or I'm on deadline and trying to polish and finish something. So I'm always in the process with many different books. Right now I'm outlining one book. I'm in first draft of another book. I just did copy edits of the third book. It's just a cycle that I'm part of and I enjoy it. I think it's something that I'm good at, and I tell everybody I can't do anything else. I can't parallel park. I don't cook. I'm really good at planning vacations and writing books. That's what my life revolves around.
No, that's awesome. And we do have a lot of listeners in our community who are parents. And a lot of times we talk about how they do often feel guilt when their kids come into the room and want to hang out with the parents, but they really need to focus on their work because they're also balancing day jobs. We are aware that you have a daughter and you have your hubby as well, who definitely understands what it's like to be a writer. Do you have a rigid schedule where your daughter also understands the boundaries and structures of your timeline and knows not to go into your creative space during certain hours? How does that work for you?
No, I mean, I can write anywhere. And I think writers who do write a lot, I don't even think that I'm as productive as Rachel Caine or Lauren Oliver, both of whom I've seen right next to me when we're doing signings. They'll be working on their books while signing people's books. That to me is crazy. They can really write anywhere. And I think thinking that you need this time is kind of an excuse because you're never going to have time. You're always going to be interrupted. So you're just going to have to learn how to work around it. My door is always open. My kid comes in, asks me something, walks out. What helps as a mom is to get a lot of your work done when they're out of the house. Right now she's in camp or when she's at school. I really get a lot of work done. And when she needs me, I like to pick up and I like to spend the afternoon with her and I'm present for her. So you just need to be present for your work and then present for her. And then when we're here in the house, she's a creative person and she has her own life too. So she likes to have her own time because now that she's 10, when she was little, yeah, she would come in and we'd play a little. Then she'd wander back out. The thing about kids is they don't need an hour. They don't need that much time. They just want your attention that minute. And then they have such short attention spans. You play with them for like 5 minutes and they're on to the next thing. I started my YA career. My dad was in the hospital. He passed away 7 years ago, but that's why we moved to LA. I was writing in the hospital while we would wait for the doctors or what's happening. And I just adapted. I think Stephen King said you really need a life first, and then writing happens around it. And I think that when you make writing the sole purpose or the sole thing, the most important thing, I think it actually harms it a little bit because then you're not paying attention to the life around you. And also, I think as a creative person and as an author, it's so public what your success and failures are that you almost have to divorce your happiness from your work so that you don't go crazy, because some books are not going to sell and some books do. And I worked as hard on the books that sold 10,000 copies as the books that sold 2 million copies. You can't take it that seriously. Take your work seriously, but you can't take the reaction.
You got 24 to 48 hours to have your ice cream, lick your wounds. But then after that, it's just like, you got to show up at your best for the next one. And whether that's the next story or the next audition, yes, I absolutely resonate with you. I know you mentioned you were doing some computer programming before. Mm-hmm. So you went to Columbia University, you majored in art history and English. Where did computer programming come in?
I worked for a company that their policy was actually to hire English majors, liberal arts majors, and train them in computer programming because they said it was easier to teach English majors computers than it was to teach computer programmers how to talk to people. Oh, it was really interesting. Smart. And it was a really interesting guy who owned the company. We hired a bunch of liberal arts majors and we were trained in programming language and then sent out to clients. It was a really nice first job. Kept me gainfully employed while I was trying to make money as a writer on the side. I didn't have to worry that I wouldn't be able to eat.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was like, wait, where was the connection between that? I never even thought of it would be easier to teach English majors to communicate that way. That's really clever. I know that you also grew up in Manila and you moved mm-hmm. to San Fran with your family. How old were you when you moved to San Fran from Manila?
I was 13.
Do you remember that moment when your parents were like, we're going to go to America? Or was that something that's been known in your family, but you guys were just waiting for the right moment?
My dad was an investment banker. He owned an investment bank in Manila. And we were living under the Marcos dictatorship in the 80s. And basically, it was either work with a corrupt government and hide and launder the money or get out. And my dad, one of the most morally good people that I know. And it was so funny. I think he told me when I was little, he was like, never embezzle. He was such a banker. I was like 10 years old. I was like, never embezzle. Got it. Okay. And he could not stomach that kind of business. He didn't want to be part of this dirty, corrupt system. If you're not part of it, you have to get out. And he didn't want his kids growing up in a country under that kind of regime. So he thought maybe we'll move to America. It was funny. We were much younger, so this wasn't all explained to us back then. It was more conversations later with my parents talking about why they moved here. It wasn't presented to us as a bad thing. It was presented as an adventure. My parents were very excited about starting over. They said they felt like they were 20 years old again and starting again, but now with three children. They wanted us to assimilate. A lot of Filipino families move and they don't want their kids to go away for college. They're very worried about this American lifestyle. And my parents were not like that. They were very sophisticated and open. Because in the Philippines, you usually live with your parents until you get married. Adult children live with their parents. And a lot of their friends were like, you're really going to let your daughter leave at 18, you know, to go to college and live in a dorm? They were just so shocked and horrified by that American custom. My parents said, yeah, that's what they do here. That's what she's going to do. They dropped me off and Columbia in the middle of New York City, and parents were very strict and conservative, and I grew up very sheltered, and all of a sudden they just left me in New York on my own.
It's like, good luck.
And I asked my dad, I said, how did you feel comfortable doing that? And he said, well, I raised you, right? I thought you'd be fine. And I thought, oh my God, to feel that confident in how you've raised your child. And he wasn't wrong. I was fine. I want that for my kid, to feel when I drop her off at 18 that I trust you. You're going to take care of yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of wish my mom was like your dad, because my mom came from Malaysia and she lived a little bit in New Zealand before coming to New York and settling here. So she was very independent her whole life. She had to be independent. My grandpa was traveling around, but mostly based in Malaysia doing artwork. So he couldn't really leave back to America again, because he actually raised them in America for a little bit, which is so interesting where there's so much back and forth.
Yeah.
So when she finally came, oh my gosh, she was young. She was, I think, 19, and she took care of her younger sisters who were 3 to 5 years younger than her, and she put them in high school. She enrolled them in high school herself, then paid for their tuition in college. And that's just the way it is in their family. You know what I'm saying? And I think it's definitely a cultural thing, like we were talking about. It's very similar. Malaysia is so close to the Philippines too. I feel like a lot of the traditions I hear from my Filipino friends, it's very similar to my Malaysian roots. We're very family oriented, and it's very much expected. We move around like a tribe. If my mom moves, ooh, my aunties are going to be right there. It's going to be 5 minutes away. You could walk in like 15 minutes, drive in like 3 to 5 minutes. For them, without their parents, they grew up and did most of their schooling in America. They were on their own. But then when it came to us, the generation that was born in America, I don't know what happened. It was like reverse. My mom definitely latched on and got really overprotective and didn't do anything like dropping us off. I had to go to school in the city in New York, somewhere that was close so that I could still live at home in Long Island, but commute to school and also commute to work when I was acting. There was none of this moving to the city. And my mom would always be like, you're wasting money. Why are you wasting money? But I knew it's because she was sad. Finally, work carried me out to LA. Man, she got upset. Most moms get sad and they cry. She got angry. She's like, who you think you are moving out? You think you're all that at 22? I'm like, mom, you know, 22 is kind of late to be moving out. I'm getting shit from my friends. And she's like, why you care about what people think? This is not how we were raised. But I love that you said for your own daughter, you hope to do that where you can drop her off and be like, I have enough trust and faith that I did an amazing job. And I know you're going to be okay. You're going to fly. I'm a little jelly. That's amazing. Also, your book, Something in Between, my girlfriend was reading it and we loved it.
Aw, thank you.
That story is so freaking important. And I read this back when, I think it's like in fall of last year. This is a lot of stuff happening during that time, political climate. So I think it really hit home at the perfect time, especially for me. I was feeling really upset about elections and everything. And then reading your story, something about it just hit my gut. And I was like, this needs to be out there. Talking a little bit about your move from Manila to San Fran and also your experiences, how much of it was closely tied to your own experience moving here?
It was not based on my experiences at all. It's not my family. It's not my story. I wrote about my family and our immigration story in a book called Fresh Off the Boat, which came out in 2005 from HarperCollins. When 17 Magazine and Harlequin asked me to write about immigration, specifically a YA illegal immigration story, I said, oh my goodness, it's so hard to write that story. But I did feel it was important. And who else is going to write the story? Who else is a YA writer who was an immigrant? And so I did a lot of research on undocumented status and what teenagers go through when they're undocumented. My case was a little different because my parents got a green card. But what happened was my dad's first immigration lawyer didn't file, and he basically absconded with the money. And so we were just waiting for years. And then my dad finally found out that he'd never filed our green card application. So during that time, years had passed. Dad said, you know what? What do I need a lawyer for? I can follow directions. And he just filled out the form himself and applied for our family himself. And he, my mom, and my brother, who was under 21, all got their green cards, but my sister and I were over the age of 21. And back then in the 90s, there was no law that covered the adult children of green card holders who were brought here as minors. There was kind of a loophole. And so we had to wait again. Now they've changed the law. And if you're brought in as a minor and then your parents get their green card, even though when you're an adult, you get it now. But back then there was no law that covered us. And so another lawyer told us that we were legal to stay here. There was no reason for us to be kicked out or anything, but we had to wait again. And the waiting ended up to be so long that I actually got my green card and citizenship through my husband, who's American. So I didn't get my citizenship until I was 40, and I came here at 13. So I really understood feeling you're in the country, but somehow you don't belong or you're not quite American. So even while I was never undocumented, I know that feeling of not being quite wholly American on paper. So I say that a lot of my heart is in that book. So I definitely know the emotion and feeling like that. And, you know, it was a hard book to write because it's not a nice feeling to have, feeling like you don't really belong anywhere. You know, I couldn't vote. I was very opinionated about politics. You feel like you're not really part of it because you can't vote. So it was really exciting to vote in my first election. Very sad to find out the results.
But, you know, at least you knew that your vote hopefully did count in its own way. But yeah, it was a rough election. I felt like I was truly depressed. And I think a lot of people can resonate with this, where I couldn't move out of bed, like not even to be dramatic, but I was really down and I lost a lot of hope with that one.
Yeah.
Was there one really difficult scene do you remember having that you were kind of struggling with that book specifically, especially when it came to the emotional part of it?
It took a while to get the romance right. They had to really figure out the character of Royce, who is the son of a Republican congressman who's grown up privileged, and his journey. In that, I also drew on my own life. My husband's from Cleveland, Ohio. We're actually outside of Cleveland, about 2 hours outside in rural Ohio, where I think it's like 95% Caucasian. Every time I come, I'm like the only Asian person for miles. And his parents are Republican. And so I drew from that a little bit. Somebody who grew up in thinking one way, but then being open to another way of thinking. And I think once I cracked that relationship, the book came to life for me and breathed life into the two characters and their struggles. But it was hard. I didn't even realize. I was like, oh yeah, Republican father-in-law. I can write about that.
I love that. I just had a conversation with my grandpa over lunch about this, where when is it that we know when we are done with our work, when we are happy with the story that we want to tell? He being a painter, and also he writes privately on the side, we talk about intuition because we're perfectionists too. I got it from my grandpa for sure. He'll work on a painting for 6 months, And then he'll go over the canvas, completely erasing everything. And I'm like, how are you okay with that? He's like, well, how are writers okay with cutting out 50,000 words? So it's the same where you just know in your gut and your heart, if it's not feeling right, then it's not feeling right. But I also brought up the point where having conversations with writers, a lot of them have good, strong support systems where they have critique partners and editors that can give feedback where you know, all right, maybe I should work on this a little bit more, or okay, I gotta reel it back, I need to stop editing. It's good, it's good. How do you know? And we could use something in between as an example, or also I'd love to dive into Alex and Eliza as well. When was it that you knew that you're done and you're happy and this is what you want to put out into the world?
With something in between, we went through a lot of drafts.
I love that you're laughing about it.
Yeah, no, I'm like, I thought I was done 3 drafts ago. My editor, she was really good and she was really thorough and she really wanted to get that story perfect. But it was hard. It was a long book. We cut it down. I think there was one edit where we realized because it's a contemporary story, we had to follow certain, this is when people find out they got into college. This is when the national cheerleading championships are. This is when prom is. And I had kind of had things moved around. And so I had to move things so that it would happen in the right order in real life. That was a hard edit. When the timeline was screwy.
I'm glad you came out alive, though. And how about Alex and Eliza? Listeners, please do pick up your copies of Melissa's work. Alex and Eliza recently came out in April of this year. Something in between that we've been talking about came out in fall of 2016. Beautiful book. It's super important. Could we have a snapshot from your own perspective of what you want the listeners to know about Alex and Eliza?
Yeah, Alex and Eliza is about Alexander Hamilton and Elizabeth Schuyler's courtship. And I was inspired to write it by my daughter, who was obsessed with Eliza after seeing Hamilton, which we loved. She kept drawing pictures of Eliza, asking questions about Eliza. And she said stuff like, you know, it really should be called Eliza, Mama, because without her, we wouldn't know his story. And so I was doing research to answer her questions. And then I realized it's this beautiful fairy tale story. This young, penniless, nameless orphan who marries this rich American princess. And it felt like a classic YA fairy tale, even though there was sadness and unfaithfulness later in their marriage. I think I wrote it because she forgave him and she loved him and she devoted her entire life to him, even after something so dark happened in their love story. And so I wanted to celebrate their early life because mostly from his letters, you know, they were so romantic and even how he talked about her. I'm a practical person too. And the way he wrote about how he wanted a sensible, it'd be great if she had money, but it would be great if she was sensible and practical. And mostly he really was attracted to her because of her good sense. And I was just so attracted to that, this guy who was this flirt, this charismatic, handsome, brilliant man. But he just really wanted this really good, sensible girl. And I just also fell in love with her through his letters. I really wanted to write about a good person and about somebody who was just the embodiment of American virtue. And she wasn't perfect. And the character in my book is not perfect. She definitely is stubborn and maybe a little opinionated and maybe as impulsive as he is, but somebody who really wants to do something good. And I think it was almost a reaction to our culture that kind of celebrates these bad boys, these flawed anti-heroes. I was a little tired of these flawed people. And I wanted to write about somebody almost like Harry Potter who just wanted to do something good. And I really thought that their early story was really romantic and dashing, this dashing soldier, and they fell in love very quickly, but not immediately, because we know that they met in 1777 at a ball, but they didn't fall in love until 1780. So it's a fictional embellishment of what happened and a little bit of an homage to Pride and Prejudice.
Did your daughter get a chance to read it?
No, she refuses.
I know she is 10.
She is 10 and she'll read it at some point. She likes to read things when I'm writing them. So she's read early drafts. She likes to be part of the conversation.
That's awesome.
So she likes being part of my husband and I going over edits and talking about things. But when the books are done and we don't talk about them anymore, she's not interested. She likes it when in the creation of it.
I'm sure your work and your husband's as well, it's probably influenced her to write her own stuff, hasn't it?
You know, I think all kids think their parents are lame. You know, I think the Matt Groening created The Simpsons, the most iconic, funniest cartoon the last 20 years. His kids told him, "Dad, we don't think you're funny." So, yeah.
That's insane to me. I would be like, oh my gosh, this is so amazing. I have a mentor every day. But I guess you're right. Your kids just see
they
you as like
you
humans.
Mom and dad.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. As humans. Where it's like, I think about the same thing where I wonder like Angelina Jolie's kids. They're not like, oh my God, you're Angelina. It's like, all right, mom, where's my food? You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Where's my breakfast? Let's go. Your daughter is so cool. I bet she's freaking popular in school too. I bet she's like one of those where everybody wants to be friends with her.
She's very confident.
That says a lot. You did some amazing parenting. Raising confident children is hard. My sisters came out super confident. For me, when I was younger, I got bullied a lot. So that definitely messed with my confidence. But my sisters, even if anyone tried to pick on them or bully them, especially if it's like race related, oh, hell no, they would just give it right back to them and really stood their ground. And I really am so proud of them for that. Before we wrap it up, would it be okay, Melissa, if we can throw in two listener questions for you?
Sure.
They're big fans of yours and they love your work. First one is Tara Turley Creole. She says she loves you. And how is it for you seeing your books as movies and a TV show? And what role do you get to play with these?
Yeah, you know, it's really exciting. It's kind of surreal. It's definitely something that when you don't have, you want so badly. You want to see it and you want to see it on screen. And when you hear that it's happening, my agent and I went down to tape the pilot of Witches of East End, and I got to meet all the actors and actresses, which was amazing. I felt I was the fairy godmother, or you're not the
yeah.
parent because
yeah.
you're not working on it. I've done both. I've been in projects where I was a lot more involved. Blue Bloods was supposed to be a TV show, and I was writing the pilot and working with everybody, but then it didn't get picked up, and it was so devastating. And I really felt, oh my goodness, we did all this work and nothing happened from it, which happens a lot in Hollywood, which is more common than not. And everybody else just went on with their lives. But I was really stunned by it because when I write something and work on something, it becomes a book. There's something to show for it. And so when we did Witches, I said, I don't really want to be that involved. I said, it's too emotionally draining. It's just too much highs and lows. So I told them, yeah, you know, have fun. And then Maggie Friedman, who was our showrunner, wrote the script and sent it to me. And it was just lovely. I mean, she distilled the book into a script. And I was actually, it was like so moved. I was moved to tears about how wonderful it was. It was just a really fun experience because I enjoyed the show. I loved everybody on it. And I liked the people who were running it. And I got to visit the set a couple of times. But I didn't have to work on it. I just cashed the check, which was really fun. And then now I'm doing a couple of projects where I'm a lot more involved, which I'm also enjoying. And I think now, because I know I've gotten both experiences where things have happened and things haven't, now I think I'm a little bit more sanguine about things. So hopefully we'll see a couple of these shows on air. We are supposed to be shooting a TV movie that I wrote for Hallmark called Angel Falls this August.
That's exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. So that'll be really fun. It's kind of like everything in the end, it's work, and it's not this dream. It's just a fun thing that you get to do. And I see it as something additional to the books, and I like working with people. I work with people that I like, and I just have a good feeling about it. And a couple of the projects that we have going on are people who've read my books when they were young, and now they're in a position of power, and we're going to make them together. So that's kind of cool.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
I think that's like the biggest compliment. And Tara also had another really good question for Blue Bloods. She's wondering if you had the whole series mapped out from beginning or did it grow organically?
I kind of knew where it was going and I knew that I wanted to write about 9 books and it ended up being 7. I did a big series outline. So I knew exactly how it was going to go, how it was going to end. And I pretty much knew what each book was going to be. And I think you need to do that for a big series.
You yeah, know, I was going to say, and really stay helpful in your timeline too. I'm sure that helps.
So everything was planned out. I'm a planner.
I love that. And Tara also ended on the note saying, oh, and just that we love her. So, and then she put emojis of hearts and smiley faces. She really loves your work. And our last question for our listener questions is from Rachel Ashworth. She said that she's working on a Beauty and the Beast retelling that is dark. And if there's any advice about maintaining a balance between her story and the one beloved by the young audience, she'd be so happy if you can share any thoughts of yours.
I think that you need to be able to keep the aspects of the story that people love, bones of it, like whatever drew them to Beauty and the Beast should be in the retelling. But you can change a lot of details and you can twist it a little bit. So I think respectful of what made that a classic fairy tale. And in a way, it's almost it's somebody who falls in love with somebody who is not beautiful. I mean, that could just be it. And then everything else has changed. It can't be unrecognizable. I think it has to be recognizable as part of the original fairy tale should come through, definitely.
Thank you for that. Before we wrap it up, I attended Y'all West for the first time, and I have to say that you and your team did such an amazing job. You are all so organized. It blew my mind. I'm like, wow, these are young people attending, but everything is so calm and organized. You guys just had such a wonderful energy. Everybody was so positive, from volunteers. Love the volunteers. One of the volunteers, Alyssa Coleman, is actually a longtime listener of ours. They're just so warm to every single person that attends and is just there to be a part of the festival. And I noticed that you also are advisory board of Facing History. You guys are reaching many, many school children nationwide, and it's about teaching empathy and social justice. Is there anything you want to share with our listeners about that?
Yeah. Facing History is a program that I think we reach about 3 million LA school children. And I don't know what the numbers are nationwide, but it's basically a curriculum that teaches empathy. And that, even from our latest election, it's really important to teach kids how to empathize and how to put themselves in somebody else's shoes, how to see people who are different as fully human as you are. We work with a lot of books, Wonder, To Kill a Mockingbird, and basically teach this, how to build character. So it's a really wonderful organization. And the kids who come out of Facing History classes have more critical thinking. They are more independent. They can think for themselves and hopefully are moved to empathize more with people.
We always ask our guests if they have any query letter tips. We have a lot of listeners who are in the querying trenches, or if there's any advice you want to give to listeners who are on their own writing journey, writing their own manuscripts and just getting it out there.
Sure. I think that a lot of writers really are worried about rejection, and because of that, don't send their stuff out. So my biggest advice is to send it out, get rejected, develop a tough skin, and keep on knocking on that door. I was rejected many, many times, and I was never afraid to send my stuff out. I was never afraid to have other people read it and to comment on it and to get better at it. Listen to the criticism, especially of people who are professionals. In case maybe an agent says, like, you're writing, but if you would do this, it would be better. Really take that to heart. They're trying to help you. I had editors early in my career who helped me, who said, not buying this book, but I see a voice in you. And one of the biggest advice that one of these editors gave me was to try to write professionally as a journalist, which I'd never thought of before. But he said, you can build your clip file, you can show that you've written professionally, you can work with a deadline. And, you know, these are all things that will make it easier to sell your next book. And these days, there are so many outlets. You can get published on the internet, have a voice out there. Definitely, if you want to get published, keep on trying and just start out wherever you can. Start out the ESPN blog, whatever, HuffPo, and just get your writing chops. Listen to editors. I was lucky enough to work with some really great editors early in my career.
And that wraps up our episode with the awesome Melissa De La Cruz. Melissa, it was so much fun having you on the show, and thank you for your time. Storytellers, I hope you loved Melissa's episode. There were so many fantastic takeaways. As always, thank you so much for hanging out with me each week, and I am so grateful for your support. please hop on over to Twitter and say hi to Melissa at Melissa De La Cruz, and head over to her show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Melissa De La Cruz. At the top of the show, you heard me talk about Overdrive and their new app, Libby. I've been a huge fan of Overdrive for 6 years. I first discovered them when I moved into my own place for the first time ever and needed a positive distraction after a breakup. The library down the block from me had these pamphlets about Overdrive that explained how to borrow ebooks and audiobooks with my library card for free. I was obsessed and started borrowing audiobooks back to back, starting off with some self-help books to give me a boost during the breakup. Fast forward 6 years, I am super happy and have grown a lot as a person, and it's awesome to see that Overdrive has gone the same direction in terms of growth and expansion, and now has Libby, their brand new app they built with a lot of love. The app was designed to get people reading as quickly and seamlessly as possible, and this was all inspired by user and library feedback. So think of Libby like a librarian in your pocket. She's a one-tap reading app from your library and Overdrive. While millions of people around the world use their library to read books every day with Overdrive, half of the United States alone doesn't have a library card. Overdrive wants to change that with Libby, and Libby has also been designed to recommend awesome books to read next. I honestly could not be more proud to collaborate with a team that exists to spread literacy, reading, and libraries. Be sure to download Libby on your phone or tablet and rediscover the magic of libraries. Head over to meet.libbyapp.com. And don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other listeners from our show at facebook.com/group/88cupsoftea. I can't wait to meet you in there. That's facebook.com/group/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you in the next episode.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.